June 6th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are here at the end of A Study in Scarlet, the very first Sherlock Holmes novel. Time to discuss it and all of our other favorite first stories. There's so many great characters out there. And we decided we're going to ask our listeners, what is your favorite first story from your favorite character? So let's go through our favorites first before we get to our listener feedback. Pam, what is your favorite first story for your character?
Okay, so this was a really hard decision, and I went through a lot of different options. I ended up going with Laurie R. King's Mary Russell series, and partly that's because this is the Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes novels. And so, in my opinion, Laurie R. King is perhaps the very best of the pastiche writers. So she's written this series. It's at 15 novels. Book one is called The Beekeeper's Apprentice, came out in 1994. And it tells the story of Mary Russell, this young girl. She's 15 years old in that book. She was born in 1900. And she meets a middle-aged Sherlock Holmes, who is a beekeeper at the time, because remember, he retires to become a beekeeper in Sussex. There's a mystery, and he becomes her reluctant mentor. And so what I really love about the series as a whole, but book one especially, is that Laurie King knows Sherlock. I mean, her understanding of that character. I mean, there's a bunch of ways to interpret Sherlock, of course. I should say it's exactly like mine. And so when I picture, like, what would a middle-aged Sherlock look like? It's Laurie King's Sherlock. And then her character, Mary Russell, is this really awesome, super strong young feminist with terrible eyesight. And I'm like, again, so for a person like me, it's just those details. Like, for me, like, you know, I'm so lost. If I don't have my glasses, my entire perspective is really lost. And she does a lot with observation and sight with this character. So anyway, I won't go further than that to start, but I really love that series. And I think the first book in which we get this other perspective on Sherlock is amazing.
So you suggest that one. You think that one is something
highly
that
recommend.
Our listeners would definitely enjoy after their study of Sherlock Holmes.
And I will just say that Laurie King has, I don't want to get her degrees wrong, but she has studied theology at a very high level. She's done graduate work in theology and philosophy, and you can feel that. Like, so these books, they're great pacing, they're great stories, but they're very, very deep in thinking about the same epistemological frames. What do we know through science? What do we know through religion? What's the relationship between the natural and the supernatural that Doyle is really interested in? So that's one of the reasons that she's kind of like got her finger on the pulse of these novels.
Wow. I have never read these. And now you've given me more stuff to read. Thanks, Professor.
Well, you never know. We may eventually run out of material, and we may have to keep going. Because, you know, COVID-19, you know, it's going to be
go
solved shortly.
Go on for decades at this point. Chip, what is your pick?
I didn't pick my favorite character or anything. I basically sat down and I said, well, probably who is the most significant franchise, most significant character on an ongoing series? And I picked Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone or the Sorcerer's Stone.
Depending on your country of origin.
Yeah, just depending upon where you came from. But I would say that J.K. Rowling certainly knew how to create a universe, create something that not only just brought the reader in, just captured the imagination. And so much is built upon it. I cannot think of a franchise. We're eventually going to get to Star Wars, but you know what Rowling's vision was able to do is actually have an incredible, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. She created incredibly complex characters, and it was written for the everyday person. I don't think, even though the books got longer and longer and longer, I don't think the level of reading got more difficult. Although, you know, for the young people who started reading it when they were young, I remember I was standing in line and I had a couple of ladies behind me. I had Helena and Lydia with me, and it was like a midnight release, and Lydia's on my shoulders and I'm holding Helena and they're all trying to sleep on me as we're picking up this book. But the ladies behind me, they had started reading them when they were little girls and they were college students now. And it was just something they shared. And certainly you just recognize as this line's wrapped around this great big store and they've got pallets of books, how it touched just an entire generation. And I think that as we play around and talk Star Wars and use Star Wars memes and phrases and things like that as shorthand and code to wink at one another, I think their generation uses a lot of the Harry Potter stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 3 points for Steve for bringing up this podcast, you know, that type of thing. I truly enjoy this. Here's the interesting part. I read this to my children, and they didn't enjoy it at all. They are not Harry Potter people. But for a large group of people, it certainly hit them on an incredibly deep way.
It is definitely a cultural touchstone. You certainly nailed it there, that we have this shorthand of Harry Potter. This is a part of our culture for the last 23 years. And everybody knows of it, even if they don't know the material.
And I think that one of the really important elements of the Harry Potter franchise is that adults read YA books before this, but like this really brought a lot of adult readership into the young adult world. And I think that's a really, really positive thing because I think a lot of what's happening in young adult literature is super relevant to all of us. And if you're parents of young adults or interact with young adults in any way, it is really eye-opening to be reading YA lit. And so I really recommend that. So my girls love Harry Potter. And yeah, like the houses, like what house are people from? You know, everyone agrees Sherlock, Slytherin, but what about Watson? There's some debate, you know, in my house and elsewhere, what house would Watson be? Gryffindor is the obvious answer, but not everyone agrees with me.
Would Sherlock Holmes be a YA young adult writing today?
No, because he's a grown-up doing grown-up work. YA literature is specifically focused on main characters who are 12 to 18.
Okay.
Yeah, we had that conversation with Cory Doctorow when he wrote his story, Little Brother, and how that is a YA novel directed directly at my students, that age category, that middle school and high school age, and giving them information about society and how to be a part of all of this. Harry Potter certainly is a cultural touchstone. But not the best cultural touchstone, Chip. The best cultural touchstone is Star Wars from 1977. Star Wars, Chip. Star Wars. This is the best introduction of characters. The first story, which is a movie called Star Wars.
Chapter 4, A New Hope.
No, it's a movie called Star Wars. This is the introduction of not only Luke Skywalker, but Princess Leia, Han Solo, Chewbacca, R2-D2, and C-3PO. This is an almost perfect introduction of these characters. We know these characters by the end of this story, but really, this is the introduction of Darth Vader. This is the unmistakable central character for the entire saga. He is this force, pardon the pun, that enters the scene and is the most dangerous villain in all of literature and can be the most destructive force possible. He is the main character that we see, and he makes such a great entrance in the
He's the main character of Star Wars?
Of the saga, yes, sir. This is the story of the Skywalker.
You would know that from watching Star Wars?
That
Luke is the focus of the Star Wars.
Of the first story, yes. But of the entire saga, it is Anakin Skywalker who is the central character from beginning to the end. Yes, Luke is the next generation. We didn't know that in 1977 with the first movie.
Are you an angel?
I hate sand.
It's coarse. It gets Star everywhere.
Wars. Star Wars, Chip. Star Wars.
Little Annie.
The best first story ever.
Yes.
All right. We have now that we've solved now we need to think further though. What about some other characters? Pam, do you have a second choice for your favorite introduction of a character?
I do. I actually decided after much thought to go with Buffy Summers, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And so I rewatched the first episode of the TV show. I didn't go back to the movie, so maybe that was cheating. But the first episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show in 1997. And yes, it was just as good as I had remembered. It sets up these amazing characters. And of course, this is young adults as well. So we do get more of a character arc than we would with something like Holmes, who's already a grown up when we meet him. But I had kind of misremembered the first episode, but it opens with a young blonde woman and a dark-haired jock sneaking into school after dark. And she's like, "Are you sure it's okay for us to be here?" And he's like, "Yeah, baby, that's fine." And then, bam, she turns into a vampire and attacks him. So the show is setting up right from the first moment, which doesn't even have Buffy on the scene, that everything you think you know, every trope that looks super familiar is about to be turned on its head. And of course, when we meet Buffy, who's like this, you know, cute 16-year-old girl, it turns out she's the most dangerous person in the show. We get to meet Buffy, Xander, Willow, Cordelia, and Angel. We don't get Spike until season two, so that's a little sad for me. However, we do get this awesome intro to kick butt feminist teenage action on TV that's going to be hugely mainstream and it's going to empower young women all the way into the 21st century.
And it's such a great sequel to the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie from 1992. Because this is not the first.
Yeah, you know, I take your point on that. But what Joss Whedon is doing in this series is, I think, like remarkably different from the movie. And I don't know the movie as well. I watched it once or twice, whereas I've thought about the series in a lot of detail. You guys may or may not know that there's an entire professional peer-reviewed journal called Slayage Studies in Buffy. And it has like six issues per year. And it's an awesome journal. And so the scholarship on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I'm afraid the scholarship doesn't focus too much on that first movie, which was a bit more of a simplistic rendering, much less interesting in terms of gender theory, sexuality studies, feminism, and postmodernism. That sort of like, what do we know in the modern world and how can we flip that? So I'm not discounting the first movie, but I think like within the really rich scholarship, and as a pop culture scholar, I'm so excited that there's this whole huge set of scholarship that young grad students today are working on with this class, now classic series.
So as it relates to Sherlock Holmes, the first story being such a great introduction of the characters of Holmes and Watson, we've said it 400 times in the last 2 weeks that we've been reading this book, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the TV show, the version of that story is a great introduction to those characters, but you have to discount the real first, the real introduction of those characters, because those characters changed drastically from one version to the other.
Mm-hmm. All right, so maybe my pick is a poor one. I still recommend the show and the scholarship around it.
Chip, what is your second favorite first?
Well, I'm going to change my second. Yeah, I was going to pick Tiger King, but yeah, everybody was booing me at the beginning, so I had one that I actually picked out. But I'm going to pick a different one because I'm going to go back to what I did with the first pick. I'm going to pick one that certainly is going to be, it's a touchstone of the current young people's entertainment choices. And I'm going to pick Robert Downey Jr.'s Tony Stark Iron Man character that was introduced in the movie and is the foundation of the Marvel Comics universe, the MCU, that just finished up last May, where the Avengers movie came out, and there was this incredibly big arc, and we're going to revisit it at some point with a Black Widow
prequel.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that when we talk to young people, who certainly, they weren't reading comics or anything like that, they don't know who this character is, and we recognize this was an independent film that Marvel had sold the rights to all the big guys. I mean, Spider-Man was owned by Sony, X-Men was owned by Fox, and they did through their bankruptcy a number of years ago. Marvel was left with just, I mean, B and C characters. And for them to reach down, grab this character, and build a franchise around it that became such an important foundation that Disney went out and purchased it. And even the current Star Wars are compared to, you know, they should do what the Marvel Comics universe has done with their characters. I think that this is going to be very important to the young people of today, because it is, once again, it will become the shorthand of how to relate to something. So whether you're talking about the Guardians of the Galaxy, another B or C level character group that was put together and made something that my youngest daughter says, I love Rocket Raccoon. Okay. To, you know, all the other ones. I'm going to go ahead and just say that Robert Downey Jr., it's his charisma and the people who put together that movie certainly created something that is going to last beyond their time on Earth.
And I'm going to argue that they did not create that, because that's not the first Iron Man. That's a story that was told before. Yes, they told it better. Yes, the charisma of Robert Downey Jr. absolutely sparked a billion-dollar industry in the Marvel Comics universe movies, the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But it's not the first, Chip.
It is the first, in the sense that is the first iteration hit the big screen. That is the introduction that made it. Because part of it is it has to be a serial. It's not just, you know, a one-of. So there's no doubt that his version, the Tony Stark that Robert Downey portrayed, certainly was based on a number of stories before, but they certainly were not going to be as impactful. And that was, once again, a low-budget film that just, once again, sparked a billion-dollar franchise.
Pam, would you like to chime in on the Tony Stark?
Steve, then if you're going to go there, then you're going to have to go back to Star Wars, because Star Wars is based on so much more that was not Lucas. It was built upon a whole bunch of stuff that just wasn't.
He borrowed storylines from other things and put them into Star Wars, but Star Wars was a first thing that he put together from those pieces. And so, no, I disagree with you.
So, Chip, you and I are maybe a little bit less purists on this matter. I see Steve's point, but at the same time, I think that it's interesting that we are talking about these very different kinds of firsts. And I think both are legitimate ways to think about new firsts, because, you know, there's this way that we could say, well, in 1887, you know, Conan Doyle had a nice wide open field to create a new character that would be really original. And then you start reading dime novels, and Sherlock Holmes didn't come out of nowhere.
Right.
Sherlock Holmes did come out of, like, Dupin, who we've talked about many times at the Poe stories, but there were Sherlockian types in the Penny Dreadfuls and the dime novels. So, you know, in terms of, like, what makes a great character, there's no such thing as an original great. You know, all characters come out of tropes and ideas and conventions, and it's just, like, what is the magic that creates the kinds of characters that we're talking about now, whether it's Tony Stark, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Anakin Skywalker. None of those things is like a pure original. And I think we have to admit, neither is Sherlock Holmes.
There you go. Okay. You guys win.
Nobody wins. This is just it's a general.
Oh, this is not a debate episode like last time. Okay, fine. I am going to share one of my favorite firsts, which was an original concept, which came to be the beginning of something special, and that is Clerks from 1994. Kevin Smith accidentally created a comic duo whose origin story would be told later, but they are almost perfect comic foils to the storytelling in that first movie. I speak, of course, of Jay and Silent Bob, Jason Mewes and Kevin Smith standing out outside of the action of the film to give a second storyline to that main story of Clerks. The Clerks working in the local convenience store and the video store in 1994 was the backdrop, but then there were these other two characters. And of course, Kevin was directing the movie through the glass window, so his character didn't have anything to say so that he could focus on directing. He was going to play the main character in Clerks, but because he was directing, he didn't want to do both all of the acting and the directing. So he made up this other character that had nothing to say. Jason Mewes was really just playing a stylized version of his teenage self. That is Jason Mewes on camera, not being an actor really, just being a very silly slapstick version of his teenage self. I saw myself in the characters of Clerks. I was Randall. I was Dante. I was Jay. I was Silent Bob. I was all of these characters. The characters created in this original story, first story, are pretty perfect. Yes. At the end of the Kevin Smith cinematic universe, maybe those last movies are not as great as that first one. But that first
movie... Maybe not as great.
Fine. They're not good movies.
Yes. Thank God you put the qualifier on there.
Fine. But Clerks 1994 is pretty accidentally perfect.
Maybe not as great. Well, they added color.
So I buy that, Steve. I love that pick. And I do think I would say that it's not an accident that Buffy and Clerks come out within 3 years of each other, because these two texts are doing a lot of the same postmodern work, which is to create that self-reflective element where you have the movie and then you have the comments on the movie as part of the movie. Right. And that's something that Buffy does all the time too, is kind of breaking the fourth wall, stepping out. And again, that's something that we really associate with the postmodern period after World War II. But then it's something Shakespeare loved to do, right? So correct. Every time we see something that's brand new, we always have to think, well...
400 years previous. Yeah. And the answer is usually yes, including right. Borrowing stories from other cultures.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. All right. So
The Lion King would never do that, Steve.
The Lion King? No, that's not just borrowed from Shakespeare. Oh, wait, it is. All right, so really quickly, no conversation. Are there any other firsts that made your list, Pam?
So I was going to talk about Louise Penny's Armand Gamache, which is a series that I'm currently reading. It's a detective series by a Canadian writer. I think it's amazing. I didn't want to pick two detectives, but high recommendation on that one. And the first Still Life is like an amazing version of all of the interesting topics, including aesthetics and detective fiction, that are going to come out in that series.
How about you, Chip? What is the rest of your list of firsts?
Well, I was thinking, you know, deeply about this. I actually changed mine as we were recording. But I'm going to run through some of the thoughts I had on characters and just sort of how they've been serialized, how they've grown from where they originally started, and, you know, potentially still relevant today. I picked Robert Langdon with Angels and Demons. Many people probably became aware of it through Da Vinci Code. Dan Brown. I thought of Jack Ryan, The Hunt for Red October. The one I originally picked for my second pick was Indiana Jones with Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is one of my favorites. I thought of Peter Parker with Spider-Man from Amazing Fantasy number 15 back in 1962 with Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. I thought of Frodo Baggins and all the other people from Lord of the Rings from 1954 with J.R.R. Tolkien. I thought of Godzilla from 1954. Just, you know, we've had so many iterations of that and how, you know, somehow, you know, it still finds its audience.
The character development on Godzilla 1954 is good character development?
Enough to keep it going. I mean, we still have Godzilla movies coming out, and somebody I know still likes them.
I love kaiju films, but it's not for character development, that's for sure. Go on. What else do you got?
James Bond. Okay. Casino Royale was from 1953, and you could either go for the books or go for the movies. I have Batman from 1939, Bob Kane and Bill Finger. Superman from Action Comics from 1938, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Tarzan from 1912, Edgar Rice Burroughs. And then I just started thinking of basic characters that you're almost thinking of them as brands now. And if you're a writer, you're brought in to sort of shepherd the brand for a period of time, and then you let it go. And they could be anywhere from Santa Claus to Mickey Mouse, Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh was worth like $2.9 billion last year. Bugs Bunny, you know, things I'm not aware of. They weren't part of my group, but Pikachu, Mario with Nintendo, Homer Simpson, Calvin and Hobbes, Charlie Brown, Bone from Jeff Smith, Yu-Gi-Oh!, SpongeBob SquarePants, Scooby-Doo. I mean, these are things that were still, writers and artists are still grabbing hold of them, and storytellers. The Addams Family could be in this, in trying to reinvent them for whatever the modern society is. And what I noticed when I was putting together all of these is that, boy, there's not really any women in there. And I was thinking like Little House on the Prairie. And, you know, I've got girls. I was reading a lot of stuff, but franchise stuff, things that, you know, continue to get revisited. You know, Mary Poppins. I mean, there's not a lot that I could pull from. And, you know, American Girl is a franchise, maybe when they're younger, but they've changed focus recently. And I also thought I didn't really have any, you know, persons of color. In this, you know, there's not an African-American person who plays an Indiana Jones character. You know, the closest I can think of is maybe Blade. And that was, you know, a low-budget Wesley Snipes franchise that they're talking about bringing back for the MCU. But there's just not a lot out there. And you saw how huge Black Panther was when they brought that out. I mean, the places were packed. It was certainly a celebration. So, I do think that there's a lot of room for entertainment to find audiences that are just not being represented well enough. So, there's plenty of opportunity there.
And it wasn't an accident that I chose Buffy, right? Because, I mean, I teach feminist and queer studies. And so, you don't have a ton to choose from. You're right.
So that's a list of characters, not a list of firsts. So thanks for that.
Well, they all had firsts. They all started somewhere.
But the question was, which character had the best first?
I know.
Well, they all had the best first. If I said Lord of the Rings, it started out with a story.
And that first story was the best?
It was fine. It was the introduction to the characters, Steve.
Okay, fine.
It worked out real well.
Great. Here's my list of
firsts. I mean, how do you go with Spider-Man 15? It was so popular that it sold so well in a dead magazine that they brought it out for a regular series. That's a lot of times that's how they end up doing stuff.
That's a great
Angels and Demons with Dan Brown is the same story as Da Vinci Code.
But Da Vinci Code was better.
It was the same story, man. It was different and the same. It was the same roller coaster.
All right. I have a list of firsts because that was the question. Here's my list of my favorite character introductions on the first try. Agent Cooper from Twin Peaks, the pilot episode, fantastic introduction of a character. Basil Fawlty, the first episode of Fawlty Towers, A Touch of Class, is the character, so well portrayed, put together completely on day one. The crew of the Enterprise on Star Trek The Next Generation, the first episode, we figured out who those people were. Did they change? Did they have character arcs over the course of the series? Absolutely they did. But they started out as great characters. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, episode one on the BBC radio in March of 1978, laid out those characters so perfectly. And of course, Doctor Who is one of my favorite things in the world, but the first story is not the strongest introduction to the character. The writers didn't really discover who was until William Hartnell, the original actor, quit the position, and they had to reimagine who this who was in order to make the amazing thing that Doctor Who is since then. That's why I didn't say Doctor Who.
Steve, we don't have to take our words for it. We've got listeners, and guess what they do? They send us all sorts of suggestions. Let's see what they said.
Yeah, there's so many people that added to our conversation here, and thank you to everybody who shared your opinions all over the social medias the last couple of days. Lots of people agree with Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. BJ Frankelli, Amy Rose, and Vicky Plotz-Senstrom all said Harry Potter was their favorite first. And I can agree with that, even though it's not my favorite. Yeah, I can see how it's a good first.
3 points for their group.
BJ Frankelli added Nancy Drew and the Secret of the Old Clock from 1930.
Now, I like that pick, and I wouldn't have thought of Nancy Drew. It's just not on my mind right now, but I think that's actually an excellent choice, and it's interesting because I loved the Nancy Drew books as a kid, and I thought Carolyn Keene was a real person writing these books, but of course, that's just a house name, and the books were written by a number of different people, and that first book really sets up all the tropes that all the other writers have to follow. And I think they did a fabulous job at it.
Our mysterious listener on the tour says that their favorite is Captain Jack Sparrow in the Pirates of the Caribbean from 2003.
Well, Michael Bolton agrees with her.
Great.
He wrote a song, Steve.
Did he?
He's a cinephile, Steve.
I don't know the Pirates of the Caribbean. That is not my genre. I have not watched those movies.
Well, that's too bad. Because, you know, Keith Richards was certainly a character of him was portrayed by Johnny Depp.
Just his movements, just the way he walks. That's the
way he talks.
Okay. I can see that.
My favorite meme right now is, people should be good out there because they have to think about the type of world they're going to leave for Willie Nelson and Keith Richards.
True. Hammond Chamberlain, host of Beyond the Playlist and Soundography, I had a little bit of an argument with him. He said Ash from The Evil Dead, and I don't think that is the best first, Hammond.
You're just a person who has a very strict definition on this, Steve. Us liberal people who just basically say, you know, whatever goes. Yeah, we're happy with that pick.
I've made no qualms about the fact that my favorite movie of all time is Army of Darkness. So, with that being said, my favorite character has to be Ash. Now, I can also tell you that in the first movie, he didn't come across all that well. He might have been the survivor. He might have been the replacement for the final girl. But it wasn't until the second and into Army of Darkness, and then even into Ash versus the Evil Dead, where he became more of a franchise character. I've always loved him, but he was firmly created in Evil Dead 2 and then fleshed out in Army of Darkness and then made dimensional in Ash versus the Evil Dead. So there's my answer. This is Hammond Chamberlain from Beyond the Playlist with J. Hammond C. and Soundography with Brian Ibbett.
SpyMovieNavigator.com said Casino Royale, the first James Bond story.
Excellent.
I can see that. Mm-hmm.
It's a great first. Jason Osterkamp, the host of Behind Every Story, said the web serial Worm by Wildbow. That's not one that I'm familiar with, but I'm definitely going to look that one up, Jason. Thank you. David Arfalo said Travis McGee from The Deep Blue Goodbye, 1964, by John D. MacDonald. McGee is neither a police officer nor a private investigator. He is a self-described salvage consultant who recovers others' property for a fee of 50%. This character appeared in 21 novels, from The Deep Blue Goodbye to The Lovely Silver Rain 20 years later. I don't know that one, but I am definitely going to look that one up. Thank you, David. Charlie Escher said X-Men, God Loves, Man Kills, which was published in 1982, puts out everything about the mutants and the X-Men in one beautiful book.
I think that they probably would have to go back to X-Men 93, 94, something like that. That's where the giant size X-Men, where the new X-Men were introduced. So this was a story that came probably 3 or 4 years after that.
So the current team was introduced in the number 93 of the X-Men. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, I think it's giant size X-Men. That's where they released the team that had Cyclops and what would become Phoenix, Wolverine, and they had a whole group of characters. What they were attempting to do was to have a group that were from different races and different backgrounds. So this was in the late 70s, and they recognized at that point they wanted to have a very diverse group. And this set up, this was also sort of a passion of love with Chris Claremont, who was the author of that, who worked with a number of different artists who had their take and their stories they'd like to tell. But it really became this ultimate saga. And there were always lots of women in this series who were leads. There was always lots of people from different backgrounds and ethnic groups and different countries. So it really set up a nice play of a family sort of working together, a team working together, but also the challenges you have from people from different backgrounds.
Our comic book expert, Mark Brett, would like to offer two comic books as his favorite firsts from the comic book industry. The first one is Spider-Man in The Amazing Fantasy number 15, which was published in 1962. It's got tragedy, hubris, professional wrestling. Origin stories don't get much better than that, says Mark.
He is a writer for Dork 40, so he reviews a number of books. He's got an incredibly deep understanding of the genre. He also put down John Constantine from The Saga of the Swamp Thing, number 37. This was a character that was introduced. There actually was a movie with Keanu Reeves, so you know, you got that going for you. But the original character was designed to look like Sting, because I think Alan Moore asked the artist what he would like to draw, and he said, well, I'd like to have a character that looks like Sting. So this is a character that was introduced.
My 14-year-old agrees Spider-Man is his favorite first story. That origin story is pretty perfect. Our Kevin Smith, not that Kevin Smith, but our Kevin Smith, the creator of MST3K Motivation, he chimed in with Clive Barker's Lord of Illusion for introducing the character of Harry D'Amore in the short story The Last Illusion in 1985, which was then made into a movie version in 1995. The movie features Scott Bakula. So yeah, I'll take that one. Our horror movie maven, Stacey Shaw, says she's going to choose Troma's The Toxic Avenger from 1986.
My favorite introduction to a long-running character is an easy one. The Toxic Avenger in the first Toxie film. A Troma classic that's endured through the decades in films, cartoons, and even a musical. We first introduced him as Melvin, a Charles Atlas stereotype 98-pound weakling who everyone has out for. Not for any good reason, mind you. All that changes quickly when a Porky-style prank against him misfires and he falls headfirst into toxic waste. Anywhere else this would have been the end for him, but in the wonderful world of Troma, he becomes the Toxic Avenger, an unstoppable force for justice with a mop, attacking only the bad. During his mutation, his mother excitedly exclaims outside the door that he must have finally reached puberty. And in a way he has. He physically grows up, in ways he never imagined, believe me, finds love with a woman who may be blind but can see the beauty of his heart, and finds his place in Tromaville as their saviour. That his acceptance comes from the acts of those who are trying to humiliate him is nicely poetic, and his fight for good after everything that happens to him and all the hatred he faces is inspiring. It's this introduction that made me a Toxie fan for life.
Frankie Palmisano, my childhood friend who has been on every one of these wrap-up shows. Thank you, Frank. See, I called you Frank for the first time in my life. He agrees that Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark is the best introduction of the character of Indiana Jones.
We should probably send that ark we have back in storage to him.
Patrick Sullivan says Jesse Stone in Robert B. Parker's Night Passage from 1997.
Oh, I like that pick. I wouldn't have thought of that. And it's funny because I like Jesse Stone a lot, but I love Robert B. Parker's other character, Spencer. And that made me think that the Godwolf manuscript from 1973, which introduced Spencer, also did a fabulous job of setting up the character and the situation. So I like that pick a lot, Patrick.
Jeff Johnson from CF3 says John Crichton and all the rest of the characters from Farscape had a great first opening story.
I like that pick a lot too. Boy, I haven't thought about Farscape in a while. 1999. That was a great show.
We have at least one vote for Batman in Detective Comics number 27. That's from Bub Stairts. Batman is one that we've talked about a lot in the last few weeks, huh? Sean Horn says Captain America number one, and Stormfront from Jim Butcher introducing Harry Dresden and the Dresden Files back in 2000.
That's a really good pick too. I love Harry Dresden, and I'm probably ready to go back and read that first one. I haven't read that in a while, but that's a fabulous series if you guys don't know it.
Okay, I'll put that one on the list too, Professor.
Chicago.
One of my choreographers, Kelly Baker, gave us a list. She said Winnie the Pooh, Amelia Bedelia, and Mary Poppins all had great first stories. I'll agree with all three of those, Kelly.
Well, I learned my English accent from Mary Poppins, so I have to agree.
From Mary Poppins or from Dick Van Dyke?
Well, Dick Van Dyke helped me out quite a bit, Steve. Perfect. He really nailed it. I'm sure everyone was so impressed.
Everyone in England was like, what part of England is he from?
No one knew that that was not his natural accent.
Teresa Hilliard said the original Star Trek, which kind of had two firsts. This is one of the ones that I'll allow because there were two pilots.
Well, thank goodness, Steve. Oh, you've loosened up finally.
There were two pilots, The Cage and The Man Trap, two completely different stories. Two very different sets of characters, but both sets of characters are now a big part of the Star Trek universe. She was just happy that Lucille Ball was there behind the scenes to make sure that Star Trek made it to the TV screen. And I will agree on that one. That was a big moment that Lucille Ball made happen.
Yeah, Kirk and Spock.
In The Man Trap, yes. But in The Cage, we had Pike and Spock. Completely.
That wasn't introduced to a later episode, Steve.
No, that was the first pilot was The Cage, and then they redid that pilot as The Man Trap. Our fairy artist, Shelley Merck, goes with her favorite cartoon series, Avatar, The Last Airbender. This was an amazing introduction of all of those characters, but Zuko has an incredible character transformation from most hated character with a serious family trauma to one of the most loved characters, along with his uncle, who both fought against an enemy that turns out was not their enemy, for Zuko's father, Iroh's brother, the tyrannical dictator, leader of the Fire Nation, trying to rule all nations.
Steve, that doesn't sound like those big blue cat people.
No, this is the other Avatar. This is the other one, the other Avatar. Mark Rogers says Sharpie's Rifles from 1988 by Bernard Cornwell, or maybe Captain Horatio Hornblower from C.S. Forrester, or maybe Devil in a Blue Dress from 1990, written by Walter Mosley, which introduces the character of Easy Rollins.
Ooh, I hadn't thought of Walter Mosley, but I think that's actually an excellent pick. And going back to something Chip said earlier, Walter Mosley's African-American writer, Easy Rollins, is one of the really best known African-American detective characters. And I do think Devil in a Blue Dress is an awesome opener. Thanks, Mark, for that reminder. I need to go back to those books.
These are great. I'm so glad to hear from all of you. I hope that you are all well. I hope you're listening to all of our silly conversations. And that brings us to an interesting question. What are we going to start reading next now that we have finished A Study in Scarlet?
Steve, we're going to go back to short stories. This idea of reading a big, long book, well, we're going to have to come back to just single stories. And in fact, this is a two-parter. So we're going to start with the book is The Last Bow, and our next adventure is going to be part one. There's two parts to this. The Adventure of Wisteria Lodge. And this is going to be the singular experience of Mr. John Scott Eccles.
Another Sherlock Holmes short story coming up tomorrow. I hope that you are still with us. I hope that you're listening along and enjoying our conversations. We would love to hear your voice, just like we heard from some of our listeners' voices today. Send us an email, send us a voicemail. We'd love to hear from you. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes, and make sure you get to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for a list of all of our conversations over the entire Sherlock Holmes canon, which we'll get get to because we're still stuck at home with coronavirus. I hope everybody's doing well. I hope everything's going well in your life. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflo.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
My sandwich!
With great power, Steve, comes great responsibility.
I'm your father. No, that's not the first episode.